Welcome to the 2013 ASCII-PAW Problems Other Than Alcohol panel. My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. Please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker, or indeed any AA member, be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential to our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us, and our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. The long form of AA's 11th tradition says, our names and pictures as AA members ought not be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. In keeping with this principle, please do not post recognizable photos or identifiable AA members on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social networking sites. I would now like to introduce our panel members, Casey, Shay, and Tara. They will be sharing on problems other than alcohol. I would like to thank the panel members for coming here tonight and sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us. Let's call the first speaker up. That would be Casey.
Hi, I'm Casey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Casey.
My sobriety day is July 23rd, 2010. So I guess I'll try and stick with more of the outside issues problems. I started drinking when I was about 14. I know depression started around there. I'm not sure if it started before or after. It's kind of a blur. But my parents were always really into like psychology and psychiatry and all that goodness. So of course they took me to a psychiatrist and put me on medication. And you know, at that time, I wasn't really looking for any solution other than to keep drinking, you know. At that point, like, there was a lot of stuff going on. I thought, you know, I grew up in a really good family, had good grades, went, you know, was always at school, was into sports and stuff, and then I started drinking and my life kind of fell apart. I really suffer from like every outside issue you could possibly think of. it's sick. I started cutting myself when I was like 13, 14. I've struggled with a little bit of an eating disorder off and on, for a really long time. And you know, depression, anxiety, and really anything you can think of. And so I think I really trying to use, you know, alcohol and other substances to really kind of cope with, you know, the other things that were going on. So I started, you know, I was seeing therapists and going to, psychiatrists and stuff, and they put me on all different kinds of medication. But you know, the antidepressants don't really work that well if you're drinking all the time. You know, it kind of cancels it out. And so I was sober on and off through high school, and then, you know, once I went to college, I really started, you know, I didn't have any people watching over me, so I started drinking all the time. I wasn't doing any medication or anything, wasn't going to any therapy, nothing like that. You know, my drinking and drug use and stuff really took off. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I went to an inpatient rehab center, and you know, the first thing you do is you check in and they send you to a psychiatrist, who put me on a number of different medications. It was weird because I went to detox, and I guess they put me on, I don't know what they put me on. I think like a ton of Valium. I was literally knocked out for like 2 days. And they picked me up from this detox, and, they literally like thought I was dead because they couldn't wake me up. And they took me, I don't remember any of this. They took me to go talk to a psychiatrist. I don't remember. And like a week later, cause like new people kept coming into the rehab and going to see a psychiatrist. And I was like, why haven't I seen somebody yet? Like I literally didn't remember. But anyway, so they put me on all this medication, and it worked, you know, for a little while, but I wasn't really serious about getting sober. I was in the rehab for about, I think I was there for like less than 98 days, and I relapsed there, moved to sober living, was sober for a couple months, relapsed, you know, and I finally moved back to Tucson. I was in my parents' house, and you know, I had my last relapse, which lasted about 9 months, and then, you know, finally I was really ready to be sober. I was done drinking. I knew that it just wasn't working anymore, and that things were just gonna keep getting worse if I kept drinking. I knew finally that like nothing was ever gonna get better if I continued to live this way. And so I was, you know, living at my parents' house. I'm 22 years old, and they really kind of were the authority in my life because I couldn't make decisions on my own, really. So, you know, they got me into a psychiatrist again, was in therapy, and I was prescribed some antidepressants, and I started seeing a therapist. And, you know, also I was working, you know, the 12 steps through a sponsor because at this time I was finally, you know, ready to do the work. And so I was, you know, seeing a therapist for about 6 months, and it finally got to the point where I would go and we'd have nothing to talk about, you know, and she's like, this is good progress, you know? And so, you know, I stopped seeing her. And, you know, but for me, I think it was really kind of crucial to see her for those first, you know, few months. And I don't know, the way I feel kind of about like outside help is, you know, it's never going to make anything worse, you know, and my sponsor tells me that all the time because like I'll call her with, you know, eating disorder stuff. I'll call her with, I was having sleep stuff for like sleep issues for a while, you know, and I would call her and she's like, I don't know what to tell you. I have no experience with that. She's like, but you know, this is why they have, you know, people, other people to help you. And I know it, I don't know where in the book, but it says something about, you know, going to see people who, you know, doctors and stuff that can help you. And so backtrack a little bit. When I was probably like a year sober, my doctor diagnosed me with bipolar. Still not sure how I feel about that one. I'll get into it. you know, and so I was, you know, on all these different kinds of medications, and I would take one consistently for about a year, and it would just stop working. Like, I guess it's like a common thing. I don't know what there's a technical name for it. I don't know what it is. So, you know, I get on all these other ones, and I was really concerned. There's, you know, most of them make you gain weight. Like, after you take it, you literally eat everything. So I was really concerned about that with the eating problems, you know. And I remember it was probably almost like 2 years ago. I was in a really weird place in my sobriety. I had just broken up with my boyfriend. One of my best friends had moved. And I wasn't really into AA. Like I was going to meetings. I wasn't doing a whole lot of step work. And, And I decided, and this was like delusional in my head, I was like, I'm gonna stop taking all my meds. If God is real, he'll take care of it. You know, like that was my thinking. And literally like the next few weeks I was like crying every day, all day long. I didn't know like if it was because I was really like depressed or like what was going on, you know. And then I talked to someone later, like after I'd started taking my meds again and then everything was fine. You know, and so I talked to someone about it later and they're like, well, that's a good way to take your will back. And I was like, I don't know. Cause to me in my head, it seemed like I was handing my will over to God. I was like, if God, you know, God can do this or whatever. And so I kind of learned my lesson with that, I guess. And then, I don't know, really like about a couple months ago, cause I've always really kind of had that, this music is kind of crazy. I always really kind of had like that debate in my head of like, is this just untreated alcoholism or do I have depression or bipolar? Like what is really going on? And that's always been like a really hard thing for me, because I know, depending on where I'm at with my sobriety, if I'm talking with God, if I'm talking to newcomers, if I'm working the steps, like, you know, things are generally okay. You know, if I'm not doing some of those things, most people, I think, slip into some sort of depression type thing, you know, where everything's not good all the time, you know. And so, you know, about a few months ago, well, I was having a lot of trouble sleeping, and I couldn't figure out why. And so finally, one day, I decided to take my meds in the morning instead of at night. And then that night, I fell asleep fine. It was great. And then I realized that the meds, when I take them in the morning, they make me feel all crazy. So I just stopped taking them. And I talked with my doctor, like, 2 months after I stopped. And he was like, well, I don't suggest doing that at all. I was like, well, I already did, so... it's like too late, you know, but he told me, it's like generally people who have had, I think it was if you've had one depressive episode, there's like 65% chance they'll come back. If you've had two, it's like 80. If you've had three, it's like 95%. I'm like, that's awesome. Thank you. You know, but it, you know, he said it takes a while, you know, so like for right now, like things are okay. And I'm not sure if that's because, you know, I am working steps, with a sponsor. I'm of service. I go to meetings and I, you know, I try and stay in contact with my higher power. But, you know, I know that if things, you know, start to go bad, that, you know, going back on the medication is always an option, you know. And same kind of thing, like when I talk to my sponsor, you know, she's always told me, like, and she's been suggesting therapy for years, you know, for me. And she's like, it's not gonna make anything worse, you know, and like, that's kind of how I look at it, is like, it's never really gonna make anything worse, you know, so, I don't know, there's been, you know, a couple other things, like, with the cutting, like I went to, a couple other, one of my friends in the program started, like, a 12-step program kind of thing for cutting, and that was helpful for a while, you know, cause I was able to talk to a person who, you know, like, hadn't done any of that in, you know, years, and for me, it had only been a couple months, so it was, like, the same kind of thing as drinking, you know, I come in as a newcomer, and I talk to people who have had, whether it's a few days more than I do, a few months, a few years, like, I can get their experience, you know, and grow from that, you know, so for me, it's been really important to, talk to like other professionals and other people who, you know, have my experience. Yeah, I'm good. All right. I don't know if that was helpful at all, but, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Casey. We'll now have our next speaker, Shay.
Hi guys, I'm Shay and I'm an alcoholic. I'm short. So we're gonna make this work. How's that? Okay. So sharing. Thank you for asking me to share. This is something that's a subject that's very near and dear to my heart. I think it's great that there's a panel on this. I know I've tried to share about this topic in AA meetings, and I get talked to, well, this is an outside issue, and don't talk about it in meetings and that sort of thing. And the more I talk about it, the more I came to realize that many people, not just me, you know, have this experience in AA. So the one thing I wanted to do is start out and then look at what the literature says. And in the literature in the big book, it says on page 133, now about health. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. You know, and we're convinced that a spiritual mode of living is the most powerful health restorative. We who have recovered from serious drinking are miracles in mental health, but we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. And then it goes on and just says, God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Most of them give freely of themselves. You know, and that's really, really reassuring because, you know, in my recovery, I have had hospitalizations, and I've had sponsors tell me, well, you know, I'm not going to visit you. Maybe you, you know, missed something in your sixth step, and you're depressed because you didn't ask for that character defect to be removed, so I'm not going to visit you in the psych hospital. And so I push back to my sponsor, and I tell my sponsor, if I had a broken leg, would you come visit me? And she said, well, yeah, of course I'd come visit you. And so that truly hurt, and I basically fired her. But she was able to go back and look at some of the literature and say, okay, well, I don't have experience in this, and you need to go to someone who does. I can take you through the 12 steps in AA, and all these other outside issues continue to get outside help. And I've also had sponsors and people in program tell me, if you're on prescription medication, you're not really sober, so stop taking it. Fortunately, I never did that, but I've also known some people who have done that, and they end up either relapsing in a best case scenario and coming back. In a worst case scenario, they get off their medication and they're dead. And so it's a very serious topic, and it's a topic that's affected me personally in that benefit. And I also want to share that when people come to me and ask me what my opinion on outside issues is, I pulled up, there's a pamphlet that the World Service put out, and it's the AA member medications and other drugs. And so that's also very useful for people who are on prescription medications, who are confronted, well, you're picking up a dirty chip because you're on Zoloft, or you're picking up a dirty chip because you're on Suboxone. Go to that pamphlet, see what the World Services say, see what the literature says. It's all in there. And now a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope. I struggled with depression the majority of my life, but I was always too cool to call it depression. It was an anger issue or PTSD, right? Because PTSD is so much cooler than depression. And depression to me was something that was part of my personality. PTSD was something that I had as a reaction to something that was done to me. So by allowing myself to go around and say I have PTSD, I continue to perpetuate being a victim, right? Because I have this post-traumatic stress from trauma or abuse that I went through as a kid. And that's what I went through. You know, my story starts with being 10 years old and, you know, my dad taking a metal baseball bat and swinging it at my brother. And my mom tried to stop him and said no, and she stuck her thumb in the way, and he continued to swing it, and it shattered her thumb. And so that was my first drink, was that day. And that was the day that I basically emotionally disconnected myself from dad and said, that can't be my father, you know. And then also as a little 10-year-old, I was very excited because now here was some solid evidence that, you know, my mom could actually leave my dad. I mean, who wouldn't leave someone who did that to them? So we go to the hospital, and my mom basically convinces the staff there that it was a pressure cooker that fell on her thumb, not my dad, and she protected him. And so that was the day I basically emotionally decided that that couldn't be my mom. And so at that point, I didn't know I was doing this consciously, but I turned my will and my life over to the bottle. That was my first drink, and I continued to drink because that sort of abusive situation continued to happen at home. And I didn't know what to do with it, so by the time I was in college, I was a full-fledged just drinking, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I did well in college, and alcoholics aren't college students. Again, it goes into that pride and it goes into that ego. And pretty much every semester that I was in college, my friends dragged me into counseling, dragged me into therapy. So I've been in therapy, in and out of therapy, since 2001, since I was a freshman in college. And I was very fortunate that, you know, I was a psychology major, and a lot of my professors were very compassionate towards my situation. But they never really asked about my drinking, or maybe they did, and I was able to say, oh yeah, I just drink on weekends like college students, and they never really looked at that. And so they sort of diagnosed me with depression and PTSD and that sort of thing, and I've always had really bad nightmares and a really hard time sleeping. And so apparently I would get drunk and do a lot of shots of Jose Cuervo or whatever it was, and then I would pass out for a little while, and that was great. And that was about the only way I could ever go to sleep, was either passing out using drugs or alcohol. And then I would hear that in the middle of the night I would wake up like screaming, kind of reenacting the trauma, and basically screaming, I just want the pain to go away. And I woke up and I would never have recollections of this, and my friends told me that this was going on. So then back to therapy I would go. And so I could totally relate to, if you're on psych meds or having therapy, it's really hard to make any progress unless you're sober, right? I mean, I made some progress. I made enough progress to graduate cum laude and graduate and get that degree and that sort of thing. And basically what happened was, in my final year of my master's program in psychology, one of my friends sat me down at a bar and they basically said that you need to do an internship at this intensive outpatient program that's going to change your life. And I didn't know why she did what she did, and she still doesn't know why she did what she did, but I listened to her and I went and I did this internship. And in my internship, I was able to develop the intensive outpatient program, which is pretty cool. I pretty much wrote an IOP program. And I didn't do drugs because it was a very small town, and I didn't want like my dealer to end up being one of my clients. So, but I continued to drink. And what happened was, is I would run these groups, and then you guys would talk about 12 steps, and you guys would talk about getting a sponsor, and you guys would talk about having the sense of family and camaraderie and community that I longed so badly to have. So I finished that internship, and then I took a 3-year hiatus from my field and went and got sober. And I got a sponsor, and I tell people this today in recovery, and based on my experience, that some people get sober and mentally get happier because the using played a part in the depression and played a part in the mental health stuff. Other people get sober and they go batshit crazy because the drinking and the using was used to self-medicate or mask. Right? I had enough textbook knowledge to know that when I got into therapy and they prescribed me these medications, that I wasn't going to take it because I didn't want to stop drinking. So once I stopped drinking, those nightmares and night terrors and the inability to fall asleep at night turned into hallucinations. And the hallucinations was in the form of a Grim Reaper. And he would follow me around with a machete or their little, you know, whatever the hell they carry, what they carry. Yeah. Huh? Sickle, yeah. And basically tell me, you know, I'm going to kill you before, if you don't kill yourself, I'm going to kill you, right? And so you rewind, I said back in college, the only time I would be able to sleep is if I was drunk or inebriated, or I would find a corner and I'd be at a party and I'd feel safe around my friends and I'd sit in a corner and I'd just like fall asleep at a party. And I would just try to explain to people, this is how I fall asleep. And in early recovery, I would sleep in meetings. And I know some people would say, that's really fucking disrespectful. And I'd say, you know what? This is the only place that I feel safe, that I can sleep. So I would just go on the corner of Easy Does It, that was my home group, for a really long time, and I would sleep. And the other thing that I would do to kind of help these nightmares and night terrors and hallucinations go away is I got a job working graveyard shift. And at that time, I do karate. I have always done karate. That's a whole other story. But it also has to do with the abuse that growing up in a very violent situation, my dad put me in karate, which is pretty much ironic because he was one of the abusers. But so I used that background and I used that, you know, that tough exterior that I had built, and I went and I got a job working security, working the graveyard shift. So you can't sleep at night, you might as well get paid, right? And so then I would go home and I'd be so exhausted in the morning that I would sleep in the morning. And that was what was safe for me for a couple of years. And basically, like I said, I got sober, I would have these flashbacks, I would have these nightmares, and then I would have this Grim Reaper kind of chasing me around, you know, telling me that I was worthless, I was a scumbag, I'm not worth living, and you're gonna jump into the, you know, over a bridge, or I'm gonna kill you. And so basically, with 1 year sober, I kept battling and I kept battling, and I was like, no, I'm not taking medication and that sort of thing. And all of the mental health professionals and my sponsor basically said, if you don't take medications to stop these, you're gonna be dead. So pretty much I checked into my first psychiatric hospitalization in 2007 in New York. And at the time, I had actually gotten a job at a neuro rehab, so I had pretty good insurance. So I ended up at what we call the five-star psych hospital. So it was pretty neat. There was actually a pool there. And I just remember for that first time, I felt safe. You know, I woke up, you know, that morning, and I wanted to go outside, and I wanted to do my like karate kata, and I wasn't allowed to go outside. The door was locked. I was like, what is this? The door is locked. And he said, well, yeah, you check yourself in, because this, and that's when that reality of it hit, that this is serious. You know, and for the first 3 or 4 days, I was on watch, and they would come shine the light every 15 minutes. And, you know, they expect you to sleep like that, you know, they take away your shoelaces and all that other stuff. But I really want to talk about that sense of feeling safe. And then the medication started, right? Let's try Risperdal. Let's try Geodon. Let's try Seroquel. Let's try whatever, Zoloft, Paxil, Trazodone. And some of them made my heart beat. Some of them gave me a migraine. Some of them made me feel like, they call it a chemical leather restraint jacket where you just can't move. So then in New York, we call them the rubber rooms. I would just sit in that room and I'd stare out at the ceiling and say, wow, like, people get sober and they talk about getting happy, joyous, and free. I got sober and I'm in a rubber room. A 5-star rubber room, but I'm in a rubber room. How did my life come to this? And fortunately, I had some very compassionate workers there that really talked to me and said, you know, you gotta talk about this stuff to break down the stigma, that the shame isn't that you're in here, that you had a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. And so I really took that, you know, and from there I moved out to Arizona to get away from my mom and my dad and that abuse. And one of the other side notes that happened to me, another outside issue, is because of my drinking, I had pretty much almost put a hole in my stomach and gave myself an ulcer. But that healed up as I got clean. So also now I'm cutting out sort of gluten and other things and getting physically healthy as well. So I come out to Arizona and I live in a women's home, a women's recovery home, for 14 months. The program was 7 months, but then they said, hey, you may want to stay for another 14 because I still had all this anger. At this point, they had stabilized me on Seroquel and Lexapro, and I was on that for a couple of years, and it was pretty good and that sort of thing, and I got on Access, and I was able to do some trauma work, and I highly recommend it. It was a lifesaver. And I did that. And then what happened was, as I got healthier and I got back into my profession, I was sort of that middle class, fell through the cracks. I didn't qualify for access, and I didn't qualify for my own insurance yet. And the Seroquel was doing stuff to my blood sugar, and now all of a sudden I'm sedated. I went from not being able to sleep at all to sleeping 12, 15 hours a day. And I was like, I'm a very high-functioning person. You know, I have a martial arts thing that I do, and I like to work out, and the Seroquel just makes me feel like totally sedated. So I got off the Seroquel, and for a while I was only on Celexa. And that helped with the depression, and it helped with not feeling like the scum of the earth. But then the nightmares came back, and then the hallucinations came back. And I too had that situation where sometimes you're on a medication for a while and you're stable, and then boom, out of nowhere it stops working. So 3 or 4 years ago, I had a couple of other psychiatric hospitalizations, and there were certain hospitals that I went to that I wouldn't wish on anyone. There was one hospital that I went to where my intake nurse actually laughed at me, telling me, wow, like, you really need to be in here. And here's your commitment paperwork. You either commit yourself or we'll commit you. And if we commit you, you're going to the state hospital. And so that's a little bit of my sort of mental health history and my mental health frustration and why I'm so passionate about helping other people with it. My big reprieve was this year, actually. This year and this past year, I had some major stomach allergies and digestive problems, and I couldn't hold my medications down, you guys, so I stopped taking them. I was like, these things are very expensive. You know, I ended up having to get them from a pharmacy in Canada, and I stopped taking them. And again, it's really not a good idea, but I was like, what's the point in taking them if they're just going to come out from my mouth or the other end? And so then all of a sudden the depression came back, the hallucinations came back, those thoughts, it just wouldn't stop. So fortunately, I found out that there's another lesser known avenue for help in seeking outside issues, and that is naturopathic medicine and holistic healing. So basically, my stomach problems got so bad that one day I was in staffing at work, and I left staffing to go throw up, and I came back in staffing and I started bawling my eyes out in front of the entire counseling staff. And they were like, why don't you go to this naturopathic clinic over here, just take the rest of the night off. And that's when I got introduced to acupuncture, and this one's kind of nasty, you guys, colonics. That's when they, you know, stick a tube up there and totally clean out your colon. So I did that. I got introduced to cutting certain foods out of my diet and how that affects your mental health, the sugar spikes, the caffeine, soda, all of that stuff. I mean, talk about abstinence to a whole new level, you guys. I felt like a newcomer all over again. My sobriety date is May 19, 2006, but my vegan date is like June 2013 or whatever, with no caffeine. And I was just talking to my naturopathic doctor, and I was like, I feel like a newcomer. I can't go to a steakhouse just like when I was a newcomer. I couldn't go to a bar. And I didn't know how to be a vegan. And all these things were like, eat soy and eat tofu, and what does this have to do with my hallucinations, and am I ever going to get better? Here I am with 7 years clean, you guys. And some people get sober and they get happy, joyous, and free. And other people get sober and realize they have massive allergies and massive mental health issues. But then too, my sponsor tells me, am I really judging my insides to their outsides? And I also have someone that I work with, and he always says, the book says, we are to be reasonably happy. Reasonably happy. And I can say I truly am able to say that most days I am reasonably happy. And that through all of this, I haven't had to drink. And that's amazing. That is so amazing. So basically, my stomach shut down, I couldn't take medication, and I was getting these IVs because I couldn't eat, and I was going to my naturopathic doctor a couple times a week, and I would just go in there bawling and tell her, like, there's gotta be like an inpatient place where I can go, where they can detox me from meat and dairy and caffeine and teach me how to be a vegan. And she said, there is. It's a place in California, and it takes insurance, and you should go. So I took some 5 weeks off of work this year, and I went out to California, and I got introduced to this brand new, groundbreaking sort of technology. It's more like, it's amino acid therapy, you know, and it's pretty cool. It's just the building blocks of what our brain needs to make. That psychiatric medication's kind of, you know, you take Zoloft, you take Seroquel, you take these things, and they help create more dopamine, serotonin, whatever they do, and then eventually they stop working. Well, there's a doctor out there, and he does this amino acid therapy, and he started putting me on these things. And I took like 20 to 30 a day, and it was very structured. It was like 8 a.m., you take 4 of these, 10 a.m., you take 2 of these, 4 p.m., you take 4 of these, 6 p.m., you take 6 of those, and that sort of thing. And slowly, I started leveling back out. And not only did I start leveling back out, I felt like I was a human again that had something to offer the world, you know? And the way this outside issues thing helped is I got to go to AA while I was out there. And I have a couple sponsees in here. And one of them, you know, came to hospitals with me and read me the big book. And we did step work. I couldn't imagine trying to go through this mental health stuff without AA. I used to feel really bad about myself, you guys, because I had two illnesses, right? Not only was I an addict and an alcoholic, but now I have this PTSD depression crap. And then I went through, well, now I have to be a vegan, you know? So on a bad day, I can feel really bad about myself, but on a good day, I can truly say, wow, you know, I have the steps to help me through all of this, you know? I know it sounds silly, but I can sit there and I can say, you know, I'm powerless over meat and dairy and my allergy to it right now. And it's just for today. And when I went to this program in California, one of the reasons they took me so readily is because I was already sober and clean. They said that you have really good chances at success because you already don't use, you already have a clean lifestyle. So I mean, that was really, really cool, and it was really reassuring. And the thing with my parents, you know, I worked through some step work, and I'll be quiet in a couple minutes. He's telling me I still have a little more time. I did some step work, and, you know, I've made amends to mom, I've made amends to dad, and I haven't made direct amends to dad because of safety reasons, but I've made my amends in the best way that I could. And so today, you know, I'm going to go out in a couple weeks for my cousin's wedding. I'm a little bit trippy in my head over that. Is it going to be safe? Do I rent a car? But today I get to be present in my family's life. It takes a little bit of preparation, like I'm going to have to package my food and make sure I have my amino acids and all of that, but I can function, right? So if you're sitting there and you're wondering, how do I function with all of this? You know, whether that answer lies in therapy or psychology or psychiatry or acupuncture or amino acids or cutting out sugar and gluten and all sorts of crazy things. I mean, I don't know what that answer is going to look for each individual person. That was just my answer and continues to be my answer. And continue to work a program of recovery. I just encourage you that if you're struggling with outside issues to talk about it, you know, whether it's outside of a meeting or there's also other 12-step meetings. There's Dual Disorders Anonymous. There's Emotions Anonymous. So we live in a place where there is so much help that I think the number one best thing to do is to break down that stigma and to reach out that hand and ask for help. You know, and so today I can happily say I do still get nightmares, but they're not every night. Most nights I get to sleep. This week was pretty rough. It was my dad's birthday on Wednesday, so I had some pretty rough nights. But it's calming down. It's calming down, and there's truly the hope that there's help and there's programs and to reach out and ask for it. So better pass.
Thank you, Shay. Now we'll bring up our last speaker, Tara.
Tara. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August 12, 2003. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom found Al-Anon when I was 5. My dad found AA when I was 6. So that meant that, you know, when I was developing my idea of life and what I was supposed to be, you know, learning how to read and write and have an emotional core, you know, my parents were having bottoms. And so my childhood was a whole lot of fun. And, you know, growing up in that environment, I spent a lot of time blaming my parents for my drinking. I spent a lot of time blaming my parents for not being able to have an honest conversation with another person, and not being able to fit into society and all that stuff that I didn't feel like I could do on my own. And it never really occurred to me that I had already started drinking before any of the stuff that I was blaming them for happened, so... Wow, that's loud. You know, I want to thank the other speakers here. They've been so articulate and elaborate about mental illness. And, you know, I think that's something that in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people don't think is real. You know, there's such a huge stigma. And I really hate to see that happen when somebody comes to, you know, another member of Alcoholics Anonymous for help and gets shamed or ridiculed or embarrassed. And, you know, today, through just fate, I work as a mental health nurse and, you know, this is what I do all day, is try to figure out, okay, is it alcohol and drug addiction, or is there mental illness involved, and what combination? And, you know, in my professional life, what I have to do is wait until they get sober before we can figure out what to do for them, a lot of times. And because it is so complex, it's so involved, and... You know, my personal experience was that once I got sober, those issues, once I started doing step work, and I guess I'm just lucky in that sense that my issues for the most part have resolved, you know, and I've had to go to therapy, you know, I can't, you know, call my sponsor for every little tiny thing that happens, but, you know, it's like if my car breaks down, I don't call my sponsor, I call a mechanic. Same thing with mental illness. And, you know, there's a lot of medications that are very helpful. I had my first sponsor who took me through my first fourth step was bipolar. And I guess this is how I figured out that that mental illness is real, is that she, you know, had an amazing recovery. She sponsored a lot of people and had a beautiful program and was involved in service. And one day she just got so busy she forgot to take her medication. And she spent 8 days homeless, had a complete psychotic break from reality, and, you know, was eating off of the sidewalk like a dog. And, you know, all because she forgot to take her medication. You know, that happens. Just like, you know, the other speakers have talked about that, you know, the other side of that too is that as a professional, I think that I can go up to people and tell them, you know, how I can be of service, and that's not always appropriate. And I actually made a mistake last year where a really good friend of mine, I, you know, from my professional training, I could tell that she was making some decisions that were questionable. And she had a dinner party at her house, and I was looking for silverware and happened to find some things that were hidden. And I recognized that they were all, you know, a controlled substance and the same class, and that it was not smart for her to be taking them all together. So I made a judgment call that I deeply regret. I approached her and I mentioned, you know, hey, it's not smart to take these. like I was coming from love in that, it was really none of my business. And not only did I ruin that relationship at the time, but when she had problems later, I couldn't help her. And she actually, long story short, I ended up being investigated by the nursing board because she believed I was following her, you know, and, you know, obviously I wasn't doing that, but that's the extent that my actions harmed her, and it never occurred to me at the time that that's what might happen, and I had to spend thousands of dollars on attorney fees and prepare statements, and, all because I engaged in something that was none of my business, that, you know, I have to remember that when I'm in an AA meeting, I'm an alcoholic, and I can only help other alcoholics with their alcoholism. And when I'm a mental health nurse at work, that's what I'm doing at work. And I have to keep my hats on at different times and different places and be appropriate in the situation. That I have no business going up to another alcoholic and telling them whether or not their medication is correct or they're taking it appropriately, even though, you know, that's what my training is. I have no business doing that if I'm not treating that person. And, you know, it's entirely possible she'll find the rooms again and have a beautiful life, and I hope that happens. But at this moment, that's not the case. You know, and I have to look at that, I have to live with that, and I have to pray about that and not do it again. You know, I have to let other people be where they are. And, you know, that's, you know, just like there are so many situations where, you know, in detox, that's important. People die if they don't take the medication in detox. If a person who has a true psychiatric issue doesn't take the medication, that's the same thing as a relapse. And it, I can't stand it when other people go around in the rooms taking on that professional license like they know what they're doing. And at the same time, you know, I think that because I know better, I get to, and that's not the case either. I'll pass. Thank you.
I would like to thank our panel members for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us one more time. Thank you to Casey, Shea, and Tara. Please help me close with the responsibility pledge.